In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. From political agitators to composers, artist muses, and the goddaughter of the Queen herself, Black people led a variety of fascinating lives in Victorian Britain. In Black Victorians Hidden in History, Drs. John Wolfe and Keisha N. Abraham chart some of these lives, both ordinary and extraordinary. And John joined me to share some of the stories that they uncovered. So thanks so much for coming back on the podcast, John. We thought it'd be good to have you back on because you've just co-authored a new book with Dr. Keisha Abraham, who sadly can't join us today. But that new book is Black Victorians Hidden in History. So let's start with some basic context. What were some of the ways that people of African descent shaped Britain in the Victorian era?
Well, so one of the things we wanted to show in our book, I suppose the sort of central point was that Black history and British history aren't two separate domains. You know, they're absolutely intimately interconnected. And so before you even get to the Victorian era, you've got around 10 to 20,000 Black people living and working in Britain. And in our book, what we do is we look across the social spectrum, honing in on certain individuals to illuminate the way in which they weren't just present in the Victorian era, they were pivotal. They helped build Great Britain. So whether that's individuals more on the social margins fighting for working class rights, whether that's Black Victorians in the sphere of the church and missionary drives, whether that's Black Victorians in the higher echelons of Victorian society, you know, associated with Queen Victoria, or indeed in political circles, you find throughout the 19th century a Black British presence that did much to make the world that we enjoy today. So we really wanted to show that kind of full gambit of contribution to Victorian life.
As you say, you pick out key, fascinating lives. And I do want to talk to you about some of those incredible people. Mm. But before we do, in order to understand many of these people's experiences in Britain in the 19th century, we really need to understand a bit about race theory at the time, don't we? What can you tell us about the shifting nature of ideas about race in the 19th century?
So race has an exceptionally long history that goes back to the Middle Ages and before. And in the 19th century, the very term race was quite a vague term. It meant different things to different people. But there were sort of broad kind of understandings or scientific movements, if you like, that sought to understand the relationships between different people across the globe. And so historians often talk about, on the one hand, operative in the 19th century was this theory known as monogenism, which essentially said that all humans were the product of a single act of divine creation, and differences in skin colour and temperament were essentially caused by the environment. So we're all part of one family. And that theory really had kind of institutional expression in the ethnographic Society of London, which formed in 1843, and its president talked a lot about us being kind of one tribe, of one family. On the other hand, you had an emerging theory, again with longer roots, known as polygenism, which essentially argued that human species, white and black in particular, were biologically inherently different. And on the basis of these exclusive biological categories of difference, you had inferiority applied to black population, and you had different mental and moral characteristics imputed onto white people, Asians and black people. And that in a way started to give a kind of scientific gloss to this idea of a racial hierarchy. But that was very much within the sort of scientific sphere, if you like. That type of thinking didn't necessarily permeate everyday thinking. And I think for your average man and woman in the streets, they wouldn't have been having monogenism or polygenism in their minds. And you know, polygenism had its own sort of institutional framework in the Anthropological Society of London. But that wasn't really available for your everyday commoner. Instead, ideas of race trickled down through popular culture. And so you had the rise in the 19th century of ethnographic exhibitions, sometimes referred to as human zoos, which brought people from across the globe, displayed them as essentially freaks of nature, and pitted those from Africa in particular as somehow inferior, backward, uncivilized. And these forms of entertainment really started in the 19th century as small-scale, transitory, uncommercialized forms of entertainment to become really big, commercialized, popular forms by the end of the 19th century. And then, of course, you had blackface minstrelsy as well, which peddled the idea of African Americans in particular as lazy, comical, and stupid. And that, again, like the ethnographic exhibitions, minstrelsy really went from kind of small backroom entertainment to become a massively commercialized popular form of entertainment by the end of the 19th century. And that again peddled this idea of racial inferiority. And that's even before we get onto events across the globe and the rise of empire. So race, in short, was very much a hot topic in the 19th century, and something that's often, I don't think, fully appreciated in some of our history books.
Well, you raise a good point there, that we can't really talk about race in the 19th century or in 19th century Britain without acknowledging empire and the role of imperialism in shaping these ideas.
Well, I mean, look, by the time you get to 1914, 90% of Africa was under European control. And what you see, as particularly as we get to the 1870s and beyond, sometimes referred to as the scramble for Africa or the rape of Africa, is the rise of this, you know, hard-nosed imperialism that subjugated people across the globe. And that really gave sort of greater credence to the idea of Britain as some sort of nation destined to control others, imbued that sense of superiority. It led to the rise of a jingoistic fervour in Britain. And that itself kind of contributed to this idea of, you know, Britain's right to rule, Britain's natural right to rule. And that was supported by broader changes in a kind of theoretical framework, particularly around like the survival of the fittest. The empire had a big sway on perceptions of countries across the globe and the people who were citizens of those countries, often becoming citizens of the United Kingdom as a result.
So let's talk now about some of the extraordinary figures that you do look at in your book. And as you say, they come from all levels of society, really. So why not let's start right at the top, the upper echelons of Victorian society, because there were some immensely rich Black figures in Victorian society. What can you tell us about some of those people in that stratified world and how they were received by Britain's aristocracy?
The caveat of all of this is while our book focuses on individuals, what we really try and do is avoid this trap of Black exceptionalism, that there was just like one or two individuals who kind of succeeded when all others failed. And really what Keisha and I seek to do is situate those individual stories within broader contexts and milieus. When we discuss certain individuals, I think it's worth bearing that in mind. But in terms of some of those individuals, you've got the likes of Nathaniel Wells, for example, who was a rich Black country gentleman who owned a big estate on the Welsh borders. He was renowned and respected within his local community. He had a large family. And it was funny, we went through the local newspapers at the time. And he was a sheriff of his local area. He was a church warden. He was an investor in the railways. And he was really very much a respected member of the upper echelons. So Nathaniel Wells was a really interesting case. You've got others who were sort of within the orbit of Queen Victoria. For example, someone like Sarah Forbes Bonetta, who I should say historian Caroline Bressy has done a lot of work looking at Sarah Forbes Bonetta. And indeed, if I may add another caveat, Keisha and I very much and happily labour in the shadows of many great historians before us in terms of looking at the Black British presence. But Sarah Forbes Bonetta, she was, cut a long story short, presented to Queen Victoria in 1850 on the birthday, actually, of the Prince of Wales, Bertie. And she had come from the Kingdom of Dahomey, which is present-day Benin. She had been orphaned at an early age, and she was essentially given to a British naval captain as a gift by the king for Queen Victoria. So Sarah Forbes Bonetta comes over to the UK, meets Queen Victoria, and Queen Victoria and others decide that Sarah Forbes Bonetta should enter missionary circles. So she's trained up as a missionary, first in Sierra Leone. She then comes back to the UK, and she marries in 1862 a man of the sort of West African elite who were very operative in 19th century Britain. And she was a favourite of Queen Victoria. She was often around Buckingham Palace. Her daughter, Victoria Davies, went to Cheltenham's Ladies' College, paid for, you know, very prestigious British educational institution. Her fees were paid for by the palace. She was actually the goddaughter to Queen Victoria. And Victoria Davies' daughter, Sarah Davies, was the goddaughter to Queen Victoria's youngest daughter. So you had this sort of like familial connection between the Queen and Sarah Forbes Bonetta's family. So these were just some of the examples. I mean, Prince Alemayehu was another, came over orphaned from Ethiopia following brutal British invasion of Ethiopia, Abyssinia back then. And he went to rugby school. He went to Sandhurst. And unfortunately, he died very young. But, you know, within the corridors of Buckingham Palace and within the broader social structures, you had wealthy Black Victorians.
Like you say, people like Sarah Forbes Bonetta are probably some of the most well-known today. And your point about avoiding exceptionalism is an important one, because lots of people didn't go on to become the goddaughter of Queen Victoria. They led much more mundane and difficult lives. So let's jump now to the opposite extreme of Victorian society. What could you tell us about Black lives that you've managed to uncover at the real bottom of the social scale, those who found themselves on the margins of society?
Yeah, so one of the things that Keisha and I were really keen to do was go to those archives from the social margins and try and resurrect human stories. And let me tell you, it's not an easy thing to do because, I mean, for example, the census records didn't record ethnicity until 1991. And you know, we went through all sorts of institutional records, both in terms of mental asylums and the censuses. And skin colour is rarely mentioned. So it requires quite a lot of searching. And, you know, again, we were very lucky that a number of historians had done some important work in this regard. But some of the individuals that we found on the social margins, they come from Henry Mayhew, you know, a big social investigator of the 1840s, and he recorded a number of Black Victorians living on the social margins, one being Edward Albert. He was born in Jamaica. He entered the Royal Navy as a cabin boy, and he worked his way up to head cook in the British Navy. And in 1851, on a journey, he suffers frostbite to his legs. And in a very harrowing story, the shipmates decide that the best way to cure this frostbite is to put Edward Albert's legs in an oven. And his legs burst and he loses both of his legs. And he's abandoned in South America. And he manages to make his way back to Britain, penniless. And he talks about to Henry Mayhew his determination to secure his rights, the money that he was owed from that ship, which never paid him. And he spends a lot of his days going to the British consulate, going to the mayor to try and get what he refers to as his rights. And he lives this sort of transitory life between London and Glasgow. He opens a pastry shop in Glasgow. Unfortunately, as he says, he was sort of robbed by an unscrupulous businessman and that never materialised. And Henry Mayhew sees him or first meets him when he's begging on the streets of London. Now, what's really interesting about Edward Albert is although Henry Mayhew kind of classes him as a black crossing sweeper who lost both of his legs, Edward Albert was someone who wrote his own memoir, and that memoir has been found. And he outlines his life, which was, you know, much more full and complex and hard to categorize than Mayhew sought to do. And yeah, we don't really know what happened to him, but he was an example of a Black Victorian living on the social margins who was trying to feed a family. He had a wife and a child. Other cases, we went to archives in mental asylums, so Broadmoor and Bedlehem Royal Archives. And there was, you know, there's a number of really sort of harrowing stories that we came across. But one in particular was a gentleman known as William Brown, who was born in British Guyana in 1832. Like many Black Victorians at the time, he joined the Navy in his mid-20s and he rose to the rank of petty officer. And he actually received a medal for good conduct during his service. He then leaves the Navy, retires on a naval pension. He marries in 1871, but his mental health starts to take a turn for the worst. And in a very kind of dark and traumatic episode, which we picked up in the local press, he actually kills his wife and stabs his stepson and sets fires to his house and then tries to kill himself. And ultimately, he's taken to Broadmoor. You know, institution for the criminally insane. In us telling this story, we wanted to tell history in full. We didn't want to sort of censor any of these stories. Often when you go to these institutional records, they're very cold and it's the bare facts are there. But we found letters from his daughter. He had two daughters and a son who had been taken to the workhouse following the death of their mother, the murder of their mother. And the daughter writes to her father, who's in Broadmoor, these incredibly moving and loving letters about how she, you know, dear daddy, I hope this finds you well, in informing him of what's happening to the family. And that was like a real moment of sort of familial love and compassion in the midst of this darkness. And like, I mean, I could go on and on. John Flynn was someone else we discovered, spent 47 years of his life incarcerated in four different Victorian institutions, labeled an imbecile, labeled insane. And yet going through his records, jumping from his time in prison to his time in a county asylum to his time in Bethlehem Royal Hospital to his time in Broadmoor, we find reference to, and this always moves me, it was claimed he couldn't speak, it was claimed he wasn't educated, yet there's a really interesting line in one of the medical reports that reports him saying that he was a native of the West Indies. He was a native of the West Indies, which was a tiny slither of his voice. This black Victorian incarcerated during the age of confinement who lives on in the archives. And these are some of the stories we tried to capture and retell to the best of our ability.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
As a historian of the 19th century, I can't but study race. The two are inseparable. To understand the 19th century, you've got to understand issues of race and the black contribution. So to not write it as a collaborative piece felt equally like an abdication of responsibility. This is our history.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Ah yes, the magnificent Trolley Sour Bright Crawler, also known as Trollicus Brightolus. The worm's captivating neon colour makes it an easy gummy prey. It's a surprisingly sour, invitingly chewy, staggeringly snackable species unlike anything else found on this planet.
Eat me!
Delicious. Visit Trolley.com to shop now.
Trolley, eat me!
These stories are really interesting, aren't they? Because I think there has been a tradition in Black history, for good reason, of highlighting, as you say, exceptional stories, people who triumphed against adversity and they overcame the odds to achieve great things. But many of these people never had that opportunity or were capable of that. Was that something that you were keen to convey?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Keisha was, she's sorry she can't be here tonight. I mean, she was saying very much that, you know, we, as historians, we don't want to cast shadows over the past, and we approached our subject matter with a sort of liberating lens, seeking to imbue agency and hope and finding those moments of freedom in those stories. And that was a challenge when you're on, you know, you're looking at stories on the social margins. And, you know, bearing in mind, this is a period, this is not true of just Black Victorians, this is true of Victorians in general. Like the majority of the population lived on the social margins, were working classes. And it was absolutely essential for us to do proper history was to look at all of these stories, those stories that we could find and present a full picture. So we were very cognizant of that. But, you know, we didn't want to sort of self-censor in that way. That felt like you'd be doing history an injustice.
But just to return to some people who perhaps did have slightly more unusual lives for a moment, several of the figures that you look at had a significant impact on culture and the arts. I wondered if there were any of those that you wanted to highlight.
Yeah, I mean, again, so many potential incredible Black Victorians who helped shape the cultural landscape. I mean, you've got individuals like Fanny Eaton, who was born in Jamaica in 1835, comes over to Britain with her mother, settles down, and we find her in the census of 1851 with her mother, and she's a 16-year-old domestic servant. Around sort of 1859, and Fanny Eaton's family have done a lot of research into her life. Around 1859, she meets Simeon Solomon, who is an up-and-coming artist associated with the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood. Now, Simeon Solomon does a series of sketches of Fanny Eaton in November 1851. And really that's the start of her kind of entry into the echelons of the pre-Raphaelite circles. And she's painted and sketched by a number of artists. And as other historians have said, she becomes almost like a pre-Raphaelite muse. And she's within the Royal Academy. She's got a huge family to support. She had around 9 children. And she's earning a living by being an artist's model. And, you know, whether it's Rossetti's painting of the bride, we see Fanny Eaton there, Simeon Solomon's The Mother of Moses, she's portrayed as the prophet of Moses. She appears in a number of these pieces of art. So her story was really interesting because we really wanted to show examples of female Black Victorians. She was a prime example of a female Black Victorian who entered the kind of cultural artistic circles of the time. But then you've got others, the likes of Ira Aldridge, a renowned Shakespearean actor of the 19th century, often hounded out of London by a racist press. But he performed Othello, Hamlet, abolitionist melodramas, comedy as a African-American Black Shakespearean actor. And by the end of his very long career, where he'd won awards and medals throughout Europe, he was praised in the British press for his acting abilities.
Well, Ira Aldridge is a nice link because he wasn't the only African-American who came to Britain and had a big impact. Many Black American abolitionists also came to Britain in this period, shared their stories and campaigned for the end of slavery in America. They had some extraordinary exploits that they recounted. What can you tell us about them?
Yeah, it's a really good point. I mean, this is very much an international period, and really it's got a very long history, but from the 1830s in particular and reaching a heyday in the middle of the century. So you had a number of African Americans formerly enslaved or escaping slavery, coming to Britain and championing the abolitionist movement. Because bearing in mind, America still had slavery at this time. And Frederick Douglass in the 1840s was a prime example of someone who managed to rile the British who flocked to these talks from Black abolitionists into denouncing American slavery and championing what they perceived to be a sort of enlightened British nation that had abolished slavery, although that story is more complex. But others who came to Britain included the likes of Henry Box Brown, who had escaped slavery from Virginia to Philadelphia in a box 3 feet long and 2 feet wide. And he traveled 350 miles in this box secretly until he found his freedom in the north of America. And he comes to Britain and regales his stories of escape, regales the horrors and the torment of life in slavery. And he actually sort of reenacts his escape in the UK to drum up support for his talks. So Henry Box Brown's story really sort of permeated British consciousness. And then you had others like the Crufts, William and Ellen Cruft, and Ellen Cruft born enslaved, William Cruft born enslaved. And they had this, really quite incredible escape where Ellen managed to pass as a slave owner, disabled, and a man, and escaped from the south to the north. And her story and that of her husband became, a massive topic of conversation in the UK.
Yeah, their story is an incredible one. So I would encourage anybody listening to go and look up more about that. It's worth saying as well, isn't it, that Black activists weren't only campaigning for abolition. I'm thinking here of the Chartist William Cuffey.
Yeah, so William Cuffey is another example of a British-born Black Victorian who had trained as an apprentice, as a tailor, and he did a 7-year apprentice as a tailor. And at the time, and this is in the early 19th century, there were a number of different pressures on the life of tailors, whether that's low pay, the increased mechanisation of labour, and poor conditions for tailors. And this led to a large tailors' strike in 1834. And William Cuffy gets involved in this tailors' strike. And in a way, that sort of gives birth to his working class consciousness, if you like. And he becomes very involved in the Chartist movement, working class movement for the suffrage, male suffrage. And he's not just sort of like a marginal figure within this fight for male suffrage. He's a central leader within the movement. And in 1848, he's actually arrested for trying to levy war against the Queen. He's associated with the sort of militant side of the Chartist movement. And he ends up in the Old Bailey, defending his cause, defending his actions, and is ultimately found guilty and is sentenced to transportation for life. And he settles in Tasmania. But he was massively vilified in the press. He was mocked in the press, but this was a working class black Victorian who was fighting for working class rights. And he wasn't the only one. And there were many more before him as well. So we found in the 19th century, you know, black radical activism embedded in the working class movements. And historian Ron Ramdin wrote a fantastic book on this, The Making of the Black Working Class, which explores, the black contribution and interdependency with the broader working class struggle.
Of course, you've authored this book with Keisha Abraham, but in the intro to the book, you do discuss the fact that you are, of course, a white man writing black history, and you quote historian Peter Fryer's question, can such an account be written by a white author in a way that's acceptable to black readers? What's your take on that question?
I think it's a really important question. You know, this is very much a co-authored book, and Keisha Abraham is a black feminist scholar and historian. So we very much approach this as a team. And I think it goes back to the central premise of the book, and the central argument of the book is that black history and British history aren't two separate domains. And so my expertise on this was as a cultural British historian that had studied Britain in the 19th century for many, many years. And as a historian of the 19th century, I can't but study race. The two are inseparable. To understand the 19th century, you've got to understand issues of race and the black contribution. So to not write it as a collaborative piece felt equally like an abdication of responsibility. This is our history. This is we should all be aware of these stories. And frankly, I've been, you know, writing about my previous book, looked at this as well. So, but I do think as a white historian, you have to be exceptionally careful. We're all subjective creatures informed by our times. This had to be a piece of collaborative history because, you know, I've got many blind spots. And, you know, we approached this to illuminate the issue of race in the 19th century. That was the essential point of it. And the primary purpose was to tell history. It wasn't to make a political point. It was to tell history as it was.
You and Keisha write about our focus on firsts. So you use the example of Britain's, quote, first black police officer as an example of how misleading that focus can be, because it's really hard to establish who was Britain's first black police officer. So how do you think we should reframe our focus when we're talking about black British history?
Well, I think for us, you know, that example that we used, it kind of illuminated two things. One is the difficulties in terms of the archives. There's so much still that we don't know. And, you know, there's lots within the archives that sort of obscure someone's ethnicity, as we've briefly talked about. So to make these claims of firsts, I understand, particularly as a historian, that the kind of desire or the tendency to want to do that. But in the example of the so-called first black police officer, we had that with Norwell Roberts in 1967, until it was discovered that actually Robert Branford joined the Metropolitan Police in 1838. Until then, you discover that John Kent was a British-born constable appointed in 1835. Until you then return to the archives and see that in 1746, there was another black constable. So, you know, there's so much we don't know that I think we always have to be careful in making these broad claims. I think the second point, and it goes back to this idea of Black exceptionalism, is if you sort of highlight the first in such a way, you run the risk of giving the impression that there was a solitary Black individual who somehow succeeded when others failed, somehow smashed the glass ceiling. And in that, you ignore the networks, the contacts, the milieus, the other Black Victorians who are operating. You also obscure the role of white dominance within that. And I think thirdly, it gives this, you know, we constantly have this idea that the Black British presence began with the Windrush generation, which is, you know, clearly false. And so, you know, I think there's a number of reasons as to why we need to be careful with that label of first, essentially because it promotes that idea of Black exceptionalism, and also because they are, you know, there's still so much more to discover in the archives.
That was Dr. John Wolfe. His book, which is co-authored with Keisha N. Abraham, is Black Victorians Hidden in History, which is on sale now, published by Duckworth. John also wrote a feature on this subject for the Christmas issue of BBC History Magazine, which is on sale now. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Daniel Kramer Arden.